Good afternoon, welcome to House Finance. The time is about 10 after 2. For the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Representative Parker, Co-Chair Meyer, myself, Co-Chair Chenault. With us at this time, I think some others will be showing up. I think Representative Katula is sick this afternoon. And we have a couple that are MIA and a couple that have bills down in a different committee. So we'll go ahead and get started. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if I may, a point of personal privilege.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you. I know it's optional for us to declare possible conflicts of interest at the committee level. However, we've done it in the past. I think this issue is important enough that I feel that I need to do this. I've worked in the oil industry ever since I left the farm in Nebraska back in 1979, and I'm still with the oil industry. Specifically, I'm employed by ConocoPhillips when I'm not down here during the legislative session. But I do not receive any compensation from them while I'm here, while we're in session. And I am on a leave of absence, as I mentioned. But with this in mind, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to leave it up to my peers to decide whether or not I should vote on this bill that's before us. So I'd like to make a move that I be excused from voting on House Bill 488, the oil and gas production bill that is currently before us.
I hear an objection.
Okay.
So you will be required to vote. Representative Hawker?
Mr. Chairman, I request permission for a point of personal privilege.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also wish to, as a person who spent my entire life in business in the state of Alaska, and I'm married to a woman who was born and raised in Fairbanks, who has spent her life in the oil and gas industry, I also wish to put clearly on the record that I do have, I guess, what would be considered a technical conflict of interest with the subject at hand in this bill, particularly at this point. My wife started working in the oil and gas industry in the state of Alaska in 1977 when she worked as a laborer for the 302, or I guess actually it would be an operating engineer for the 302 on TAPS. Subsequently, she completed her education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, went to work for ARCO. It's continued essentially in that seat through the various ARCO ownerships to today, where she continues to work for ConocoPhillips. Myself, I have in the past worked for clients, had clients in the oil and gas industry, but contrary to what you might read in the papers, I have no client relationships at all at the moment. In the point of erring on the, not necessarily on my financial best interest, but certainly on the political side of caution. Again, I have no personal clients at all in the state at the moment, but my wife is involved, or does continue to be an employee of ConocoPhillips. And with that full disclosure, I would also request that the committee excuse me from participating in this debate and vote on House Bill 488.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. I think I'll object to that also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can be required to participate and vote. Representative Wyrock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I'm a little late for the meeting.
Thanks for coming. Did you want to declare a conflict of interest also?
No. Well, if I did, I already would have through the reporting to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. And I know no legal or ethical reason to even declare one here, and so I'm not going to.
Thank you. Any other members?
I use gas, Mr. Chairman.
Say again?
I use gas and oil.
Oh, okay.
I buy lots of it, Mr. Chairman. Okay. So I have
a conflict, Representative Palm?
I don't know if it's maybe it's a comment.
Okay. And I would also like to declare a conflict. While I don't work per se for any oil industry, I've worked for a lot of them in the past. I've worked probably for the majority of oil production companies in this state, and currently still run a construction business that deals with oil and gas issues in the Keenan. So I would also ask to be excused from participating in voting on HB 488. If I don't get an objection, I'll object myself.
I object.
Thank you, Representative Foster. With that, all committee members will be required to participate and vote as if there were really no conflicts, which I think that in all reality, when we look at Alaska, we look at the makeup of the corporations that do business in this state, I think to some extent we all do have a conflict. We all receive a pension fund dividend check, and those that apply for it anyway do, and that is a direct benefit from oil and gas exploration in the state of Alaska. So I think with that we can move on and get down to what's going to happen today, and now we will take up is CS for House Bill 488 Resources, Oil and Gas Production Taxes. And today we'll hear a presentation from the administration. I believe Commissioner Bill Corbis, you're on the line with us, Commissioner. Commissioner Corbis?
Yes, I'm on, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Also today, as presenters, we have Dan Dickerson, Consultant Office of the Governor. We have Robin Wilson, Director of Division of Tax Department of Revenue. And we have Roger Marks, Petroleum Economist, Department of Revenue. So with that, and with those introductions, if there's nothing else from any of the committee members, Dan or Robin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robin Wilson.
Before we start, Robin, I guess I should say that Commissioner Mindy was, I think, was supposed to be here, but something's come up, and he's not able to be here at this time anyway, so maybe he'll show up later, or we'll get testimony from him at a later date. Oh, and also, for the record, Representative Holm has joined us, and so has Representative Whitehawk, in case I missed that. With that, Robin,
yes.
Please.
Again, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. And we are here today to introduce the CS for HB 488 Resources. And first, Commissioner Corbis will be giving a short introduction to the bill. And then Mr. Dickinson and myself, we will be presenting an overview. Mr. Dickinson is a previous director for the Tax Division and is currently a consultant with the Governor's Office. And also today, Mr. Roger Marks, as you know, Mr. Chair, will be presenting the economic theme for the CS. With that, I would like to introduce Commissioner Corbis.
Thank you, Robin. For the record, I'm Bill Corbis. I'm Commissioner of Revenue. I'm testifying from my office in Anchorage. I'm here representing the administration. The governor and administration strongly support the petroleum profit tax. 488 is a historic piece of legislation that will replace a broken ELF-based severance tax system, provide incentives for badly needed investment, provide special incentives for small size companies preparing to explore in Alaska, and higher state revenues, particularly at higher oil prices. We commend the House Resources Committee for the many hours of hard work they put in on the developing the House Bill 488 before you. We note that the committee substitute supports 20% tax rate as well as a 20% tax investment rate, tax credit investment rate. We commend them for this. Reasons why we support the 2020. At present, TAPS is operating at less than a 50% capacity. Oil production was once 2 million barrels per day and is now about 870,000 barrels per day. And by 2016, It is projected to be 772,000 barrels a day. Reisman production has been inadequate. Discourage new investments. Must not emphasize short-term revenues, but must maximize the state's wealth over the long run. And we need to keep an eye on the prize, which is the gas pipeline. Let's try to boil down what a change in the tax rate might mean numbers for the 2020 versus 2520 proposed by some. Let's assume that the price of oil is $40 a barrel, equivalent of about $7 gas, and that prices remain uninflated. Under the 2020 vision, a proposal which the governor and his administration supports, we are looking at a gas line, and that we are looking at revenues from the gas line of $2 billion a year for at least the next 35 years, about $70 billion. In addition to that, Prudhoe Bay will be extended. The life of Prudhoe Bay will be extended at least through the year 2050. Now let's look at the 2520 proposal. Under this proposal, we believe that we are looking at no gas line, a shortened field life at Prudhoe Bay. In the short run, we will receive about $200 million annually for the year 2030, worth, say, about $5 billion. So what do you want? $70 billion versus $5 billion. We note that the committee substitute has several changes from the original bill, which should be carefully scrutinized. One, the removal of the transition provision. Two, changing the effective date from July 1st to, I believe it's April 1st. And finally, the introduction of the factor. In conclusion, the administration strongly supports House Bill 488. We continue to believe that 2020 is the appropriate level to attract investment, bring us a gas line, and maximize the state's long-term wealth. We commend the House resources and their hard work to bring forward the committee substitute to House Finance.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Any questions of the Commissioner at this time? Seeing none, thanks again, Commissioner, for your opening statements.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bill. My name is Dan Dickinson. I'm a former director of the Tax Division, and I'd like to go through with you the bill, the committee substitute for HB 488. I would like to talk about both the ideas that the governor originally had put forward. I think they're good ideas, and how those ideas either got better, survived, or didn't quite make it through the committee substitute. So I'll be talking about both bills as we go through. I'd like to start out, if I could, with what I would just call the governor's three big ideas. When he was talking about putting this legislation together, the first thing he focused on was the fact that the current production tax system is broken. And I'll talk more about that later. The second thing that's been very discouraging to him is the level of investment in Alaska. And he said we need to use the tax system to encourage investment. And the third point is we ought to get a fair share of tax revenues when prices are high, and especially if the investment is low. So I think those are the three things that he was asking us to focus on as this legislation was put together. And I think as you'll see, the legislation, we believe, did all three. Turning to the next slide, let's look at the CS. The first issue was that the current production tax system is broken, and what you'll see, Mr. Chairman, is that the CS also replaces it. So I think in that sense, we're aligned there. We need to use the tax system to encourage investment, and the CS still has many of the incentives for investment, many of the most important ones. I think as Bill mentioned, though, some of them have been changed or were dropped altogether. We're going to bring your focus in on those, but I think it's important to say the key idea here is the 20% credit, tax credit for any investment, any capital investment made in the state, and that remains in the committee substitute, so I think that's very important. The third point is we want to get a fair share of tax revenues when prices are high, and the CS preserves the governor's 2020 structure. Again, Mr. Chairman, that of course being shorthand for a 20% tax rate, 20% credit. The CS also has a progressivity factor, something that shows up when prices are above $50. We'll talk about that some. That was not part of the governor's bill. And we'll talk about some of the issues that arise when such a progressivity factor is added, as it was in the committee substitute. So, going to idea number one. The current production tax system is broken. Over the years, I've testified several times on this to several committees. In our initial analysis of this for the governor, we also came up with some administrative recommendations. I think you'll recall a year or so ago when he implemented those, there was I think I had a chance to testify before you on that occasion. But focusing in on the issues that we couldn't solve with the administrative orders, we are not getting the investment we need. And the question that the governor asked us to look at is, could it be that the tax structure was partially to blame for that? The other point is that when prices are high, does the ELF respond? For many years, after the economic limit factor was in place, prices varied from a high to a low in the 20s down to the teens. We've now seen it, I'm approaching $30 in nominal terms. What we now see, as you're well aware, over the last couple of years, are prices in the $50 and $60 range. And the question is, was that part of what the ELF was designed to handle? What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is just take a moment to put this all in perspective. The main point on this slide is, and this is from the Department of Revenue Sources book, I usually pull out a copy and wave it around, give a plug for it, we put it every 6 months, I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, but I do like to plug it, is to look at the state's overall revenues and where does this severance tax and the severance tax reform fit in that. Looking at this slide, total revenues, you can see that the largest piece by far is oil at $3.4 billion, and that includes both restricted and unrestricted. Coming close behind it is the investment revenues at $2.8 billion, and that's, of course, primarily owns the permit fund. Federal money is the next very large slice, so $1.9 billion. And the small slice that's left there, the $800 million, is everything else, fish and game license, ferry fees, fines and forfeitures, just sort of the whole range of other things that the government does, which earns it money. Incidentally, of that $3.4 billion of oil, about $2.8 is unrestricted, and that 2.8 forms 88% of the general fund budget that I know this committee spends lots and lots of time focusing on. So we're focusing on that $3.4 billion. Turning to the next page, this is the $3.4 oil revenue, petroleum revenue, broken down into several patches. And Mr. Chairman, there's an arrow on the slide. When the slide was colored, the royalties and bonus, the royalties, the huge wedge in the upper left-hand corner is indicated as restricted. As I'm sure you know, that's well over half of the general fund money. That should be unrestricted. And the small slice, the NPRA slice over on the right-hand side, should be the one that got the darker color. So this slide is a little bit misrepresentative here. There's basically a wedge off to the right, which is the restricted piece. The largest piece of petroleum revenues is royalties, and in 2005, those constituted about $1.5 billion, $1.4 billion. The smallest slice of the petroleum pie were property taxes, which constituted about $42 million, although they do form a significant portion of support for boroughs, primarily Valdez, Fairbanks, and the North Slope borough. The next largest is the corporate income tax, about $500 million a year at current high prices. And the next slice is the production tax at $863 million a year. And it's that wedge, the wedge in the bottom of this pie chart, the $863 million wedge that we're focusing on today. That's the only piece that this reform is going to change. The other pieces of the pie are untouched, although I think the governor would tell you, and I'd support that, if we can get this change so it encourages more investment, we hope that the other slices of the pie grow as well. Moving on, I'm going to go through a couple of slides, and just for a minute, I'd like to set them up by going through a couple of numbers. And I just took the averages that we have in 2005. And what we start here is the destination value at the market. Using the figure that Bill used yesterday, or a couple minutes ago, production was a little bit under 1 million barrels a day, so that translates into about 330 million barrels a year. In 2005, that in the marketplace, we got $43 a barrel. I know that sounds ridiculously low now, but for many years that would have looked good. In other words, the total value of the North Slope crude in the marketplace was about $14 billion. Of course, it didn't get to the marketplace for free. We have taps, we have upstream pipelines, and we have tankers, one of which I know visited the city here several months ago. All that infrastructure in place to get the oil from the North Slope down to the markets on the lower 48 costs about $1.5 billion a year, or about $4.50. Again, these numbers are just taken from 1 year, but they're about average. If you subtract what it costs to get it there from what the value there, you can see that the gross value at the point of production when we left the lease for that 330 barrels was about $12.8 billion. Now, the producers delivered to us at the lease boundary. That's where we put our royalties on it. That's where we put our production taxes on it. But, of course, they don't get it there for free either. So what were their actual costs? Well, it cost them about $3.33 to get each barrel out of the ground. And in addition, they were making capital expenditures. We just put it here by taking their total capital expenditures divided through by the production. In fact, as you well know, those capital expenditures are being made for future production. But this is just sort of one way of gauging the total cash flows. So the total expenses there, and Mr. Chairman, there's obviously an error there where it says 96.52. It should say 6.52. But their upstream operating costs were about $6.52. That translates out into about $2.2 billion, again, that they had to subtract. And so the actual value on the North Slope after subtracting all these costs was about $10.7 billion. And that's essentially the value that's going to get split between the state, the federal government, and the companies. So, if I can move on to the next slide, what happens with our current production tax, the system that we say is broken? We start with a gross value at the point of production. In other words, what was it at the wellhead? From that, we subtract royalties. The state doesn't put a tax on the royalties, on the state royalties. So you knock that $12 billion down to about $11 billion. We have a nominal tax rate of 15%, but as I think you all know, we multiply that times the economic limit factor, or the ELF. Now, right now, there's a high economic limit factor for three fields on the North Slope: Prudhoe Bay, the North Star, and Alpine. All the other fields, including Kaparik, Milne Point, Endicott, have ELFs of essentially zero, or sometimes 0.00 something. But what we have here is the average, of course, the North Slope, because the Alpine, North Star, and Prudhoe Bay fields are so large, is an average ELF of 0.55, a little bit over a half. And Mr. Chairman, it was about a half up until a year ago when the aggregation decision raised it up somewhat. So you take that $11 billion, you multiply it times the tax rate of 15%, and ELF times 0.55, and you get $927 million. And Mr. Chairman, just for people who are going to pay attention, they'll go back and say, wait a minute, this slide's led you, we got 863, and I'm just keeping this all at a very high level. There's some other things in there, including, for example, the credits for exploration.
This is the new math, then, is what you're saying.
This is the new math.
I had a little bit of that this morning.
Okay. Yeah. And if anyone cares, I would really be pleased to reconcile these two numbers, but I'm sure you don't want me to do it now. The reason I'm going into this in some detail is I want to talk about what the economic limit factor was supposed to do and why it's broken. The economic limit factor was supposed to be a proxy. We said, gee, they're small fields, they're expensive. If they're approaching their economic limit for their cost, we'll put a factor in there, we'll reduce that cost down to zero. The problem is, if you turn to the next page and you say, okay, let's take out the economic limit factor, and let's figure out how much upstream cost there would be at 15% to generate a tax of $927 million. And the answer is, backing into it, is the number you see in red in that second line, $5 billion. In other words, for the ELF to be working as an accurate proxy at the kind of prices we see today, we're giving them a proxy for oil companies, $5 billion when they do their deductions. Now, if you flip around and you look, the actual cost, the actual expenses and investment upstream, is more like $2 billion. So as a proxy, the ELF simply isn't working. It's giving a reduction in costs, if you will, of almost 2.5 times the actual. And that's why the governor focused in on and said, this isn't working. Why are we using a proxy? Why don't we use the actual costs? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I was so carried away there. On the last slide, I didn't switch slides there, but that's the next slide that you would have seen, and if you're following along on in your handouts, you would have seen that. So the problem is, to come up with the current level of taxes, we in fact have a proxy which shows that $5 billion is being invested. Folks get to pay their taxes as though $5 billion is being invested, but we're only getting about $2 billion of investment. The other problem that occurs is that the ELF, as folks well know, it's the reason I don't put the slide up, has a couple of exponents in it. And the relationship between volumes, because the ELF is driven by volumes, and what comes out of the other end of the formula is very, very sensitive to volume. And what I'm showing you here on this slide is what happened at Kuparuk. Now, Kuparuk remains the second largest oil field in the United States of America. As you can see back here, when the blue transits to yellow, where we're looking at what happens from forecast, when we move from actuals to forecast, we're producing 150,000 barrels a day. It's a huge field. And yet what has happened over the last several years is because the well productivity is so low, the ELF at Kuparuk has marched down to zero. And one of the things that you can do, and again, I won't bore you by going through the details, but if you look at some of the years between about 1996 and 2005, and you calculate the drop in production, you can see where the production went down by 10% or 15%. And then you look at what happened to the ELF, you will see the ELF falling by 20 or 30 or 40%. So the mechanics of it are such that we have the volume falling, which for fixed costs certainly increases the cost at Kuparuk, but at least from my point of view as a proxy, it doesn't reduce the point to say, gee, if we had a severance tax at Kuparuk, we'd have to stop producing. The whole point of ELF was you shouldn't shut in barrels because the severance tax was too high, and I'm going to submit to you that what this graph shows is it probably isn't the severance tax that's keeping those barrels going. So, Mr. Chairman, if we look at the historic at the history here, what has happened to the economic limit factor? What you see here from 1995, when the economic limit factor on the North Slope was averaged at about 0.9, so a 15% tax rate would give you something in the 13% rate. The rate has just marched down steadily. Again, 2005, a small bump up when we did some aggregation. We took some fields that were not paying any severance taxes. Satellites at Prudhoe Bay, combined them with Prudhoe Bay, so you see a small bump up there. But fundamentally, you see all that was going to do is hold things constant, and you will continue to see the economic limit factor, and with it, the state's tax revenues marching down. What are the consequences? Why is this occurring? The upper line here shows us what happens to the ELF at Prudhoe Bay. And as you can see, it's declining, but it still remains fairly high because Prudhoe Bay is such a monster field. What you see below is what's happening with all the other fields besides Prudhoe. And as I said earlier, as their volumes have fallen, their ELF has declined even more dramatically. And you can look particularly between about 2005 and 2011, or 2006, 2007, where there are only very small changes in production. Actually, you can't see it on this chart, but there are small changes in production, but they lead to dramatic declines in the ELF. So, Mr. Chairman, as we look at that, we said and the governor agreed that that needs to be fixed. The final point I want to make, and here's where I'm going to switch gears and turn this over to Rob to talk about some of the governor's other big ideas, was what is happening on the North Slope of Alaska. This is a graph that I make a point of having it show up in every single one of the presentations that I give, and I just think it needs looking at. What we had here was Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay, of course, is the large orange area. And in the years that Prudhoe Bay was in flush production, that's what kept us at 2 million barrels a day. If you took Prudhoe Bay out and plotted everything else, you will see that we, in fact, are getting growth. We're getting other fields. We're getting new things coming online. The successes at North Star with BP, the successes with Alpine that Anadarko and ConocoPhillips are having, are adding new production. It's all against the background of a very heavy decline in Prudhoe Bay. And so again, the question is, does a tax system that was focused on taking one large field and producing from it, is that going to work when we've got lots and lots of small fields? And the answer is probably not, because what we need to focus on now is not the amount of being pumped out, but the amount of investment and the investment needs. And so that brings us to the second point that the governor said is, to make this work, we need to focus on investment. For that, I'm going to turn it over to Robin.
Thank you. Again, my name is Robin Wilson. The second big idea is of the governor's is to use the tax system to encourage investment. And the thought here is that investment leads to increased production, not just exploration, but actually putting dollars in existing fields ultimately will also lead to increased production. And more production, of course, leads to more revenue. And so there are four ways that the bill recognizes investment. And the governor's four ways of encouraging investments are these. To use, as Dan referred to a moment ago, to use net profits rather than taxing on gross. And I'll explain that in a little bit. That every investment is a deduction, whether that's operating or capital investments. Another key element is a 20% credit for capital investments. And the governor's bill also included up to a $73 million annual allowance. And if I could sort of hearken to people's personal tax return, that would be similar, not the same, but similar to a standard deduction. And finally, recognition of transition investment expenditures. And those have to do with the expenditures that have been made recently on the slope and how those costs are recognized. When we look at the committee substitute, then, what we see is the CS preserves the approach of taxing on a net basis. The CS preserves the 20% credit for capital investment. The CS has a similar feature regarding the $73 million, but it's handled a little differently. The CS, rather than giving a deduction, actually turns it into a credit. The net amount is reduced a little bit, and I'll show that a little later, but in essence, much of that is preserved. The last piece of the transition investment was cut substantially with the committee substitute. It reduces the investments that are taken into account from 5 years' worth of investments to 3 months' worth of investments. So again, the most important new change is that it will be a tax based on net. And again, the CS maintains this approach. And just sort of to back up a little bit, because You know, not everyone's used to sort of throwing these terms around in their sleep. But when we look at a tax based on net or a tax based on gross, the bottom line does not have to change. It is a different way of looking at it. Let's look at the left-hand column, which represents the current tax on gross. And so we start with value at the wellhead, and this is a very simplified example. I'm just trying to look at the difference between net and gross. Times the tax rate, if we start with $50 times 15% tax rate, that gives us a tax before application of the ELF of $7.50. If we look then on a PPT based on net, we start with the same wellhead value of 50. We remove the lease operating expenses of $12.50. And for this purpose, I'm assuming there's no capitalized expenditures. That gives us a net taxable of $37.50 times the tax rate of 20 gives us $7.50. So in a very simplified example, the bottom line does not have to change. But I would also like to point out that when you move from a tax on gross to a tax on net, you expect the tax rate to go up. So the tax base, what exactly is that? Well, that's what is taxed. And essentially, the starting point for the PPT is essentially the same as under the current tax, that is gross value at the point of production. Well, what does that mean? Well, it'd be very simple if all of the sales happened on the North Slope and there were, you know, these obvious sales prices, but that isn't necessarily what happens. And so many times what we start with is a sale price on the West Coast. Well, that does not equal the wellhead value because the producer has paid transportation costs. And so this slide is sort of working from left to right, but we start with then the West Coast value and account for the marine transportation costs and the tariffs to back up then to a wellhead value. And so one of the pieces of the governor's bill attempted to simplify matters just a little bit. Because under the PPT as originally drafted and it is maintained through CS, is that the Department of Revenue can allow the use of royalty value. And that would be under a royalty settlement agreement or a royalty value accepted by DNR. And this is completely about simplification, because at this point what we have are two sets of auditors, one at DNR and one at DOR, looking at essentially the same information, coming up with slightly different results, and as a matter of, again, simplification, the governor envisioned to allow the same value for both. And you'll note also that Department of Revenue could have a formula that estimates the value at a specific location, such as a point of delivery in the common carrier pipeline. And the formula could use other factors, such as published prices, quality differentials, applicable transportation costs, and inflation adjustments. And what this does also is it preserves the body of law and regulations that we currently have that establishes gross value. So we are not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We are just trying to simplify it a little bit. Okay, then going back to the tax calculation, again, we start with gross value at the point of production, and we remove lease expenditures, and those would be operating costs and capital expenditures. And there's also an allowance for overhead. Now note that 100% of the capital expenditures are removed at this point. If you think back to a personal income tax return or a business tax return, it's handled a little bit differently. What commonly happens is a business invests in a piece of equipment. It is then depreciated over its life. So if that piece of equipment has a 10-year life, there's depreciation recognized in each of those 10 years because that piece of equipment produces the profits for 10 years. So the cost of it is amortized or depreciated over that time. Under the PPT, it's handled a little bit differently. With a view to encouraging investment, 100% of that equipment is written off in year one. Another point I'd like to make is that operating costs must be ordinary and necessary. And that's piggybacked off of the definition of the body of law that is used under the Internal Revenue Code. Ordinary and necessary is the standard under the that the IRS uses for business expenses. And so, again, we're trying to simplify. We don't want to come up with a different standard, but we are looking at ordinary and necessary. And we will also look at things like how is it handled between an operator and a producer when there's a joint, when there's a unit operating agreement. So we look to industry practice also. The allowance for overhead would include expenses directly related to exploration, development, and production. And I would note here also that lease expenditures must be reduced by any reimbursements, such as from other producers or government reimbursements. So what are non-deductible expenses? Well, first on the list is depreciation. And the reason for that is we have allowed 100% write-off of the piece of equipment in year one, so there is no depreciation under this. The second item on the list is royalty payments. And the reason for that is when we start with, at the very beginning, what is the gross wellhead value, that excludes federal and state royalty amounts. So it never, in effect, goes into line one, so it cannot be deducted. The other piece that is applicable here are private royalty interests, and those are taxable. And because they are taxable, they cannot be deducted. So that's why royalties are the next thing on the list in the bill that are not deductible. Other items include taxes based on net income, interest and financing charges, lease acquisition costs, and other costs to include costs of arbitration, donations, costs of organizing partnerships, joint ventures, or other business entities. And so what we're really trying to do here is separate the things that are applicable to the lease and those that are not, exclude the things that don't need to be taken into account, like royalties, and then things that are indirect, such as interest and financing charges, those are not taken into account as deductions. Another way the governor's bill sought to increase investment, in addition to being able to write off a capital investment as a deduction, there's also a provision for 20% of qualified capital expenditures as a credit. Now, if you can think back again to a personal income tax return, you know, deductions are things like charitable donations and things like that. Whereas credits, you could think of child care credit that come off the bottom line. So there's a key difference when we're talking about deductions versus credits. And do note that for capital expenditures, they are getting both a deduction and a credit. The qualified capital expenditure credit may be taken for exploration costs and capital costs that are incurred on the lease. Exploration costs include such things as geological and geophysical costs. Another point about credits in terms of encouraging investment, particularly with new players or smaller players, is the ability to transfer credits. And I would note that the ability to, if the credit is sold, what happens is first it's transferred into a credit certificate, and that happens through the Department of Revenue. We keep track of those. And then it would be sold to a third party who can then utilize it on the third party's taxes, except that the third party can only use it to wipe away up to 80% of their tax for that year. So they cannot wipe off 100% of the tax. And the committee substitute maintains the credits to encourage investment. The CS went a step further also in allowing the state to purchase up to $10 million worth of credits. The CS did restrict it slightly, though, in that abandonment costs cannot be the subject of a credit. So overall, both the governor's bill and the committee substitute are friendly to new investors. And some of those reasons include the ability to monetize credits and losses, and I'll touch about the loss here in just a minute. An additional piece that was under the governor's bill, and as I noted a moment ago, was changed a little bit under the CS. The governor's bill had up to a $73 million annual deduction, in effect a standard deduction. And that was so that the very small players would not be paying taxes. It was, however, allowed across the board for all companies in a spirit of fairness. Under the CS, rather than having a deduction, it was converted into a credit. Now, the credit maximized at $12 million, and doing the math, and that's equivalent to a $60 million deduction. So it's been pared down a little bit from, in effect, $73 million to, in effect, $60. Now, in transforming it to a credit, there a little bit of an unusual thing happens depending on investment amounts. And so I would like to just work through these couple of examples with you. And in what I've done, present three columns. The first is where we assume there's no capital investment. The second column assumes capital investment of $5 million. And the third column, capital investment of $12 million. In all three columns, we start with the same net income of $100 million, same tax rate, and so we end up in all three examples with the same tax of $20 million. Now then, both bills, there's a capital expenditure credit, and that is a 20% credit. So in the first example, there's no credit because there was no investment. In the second example, with a $5 million investment, there's a $1 million credit. And in the third example, where there's $12 million investment, there's $2.4 million in credit for capital expenditure. And then we move on to what happens with the standard credit, or what was the standard deduction. So in the first example, there's no credit given because there was no capital expenditure. In the second, then they are allowed up to $5 million. So we've got a $5 million credit right there. And in the third example, they're allowed $12 million. So what does that yield? In the first example, then, they have to write a check for $20 million. In the second example, they write a check for $14 million. They have saved $6 million by spending $5 million in capital expenditures. And in a third example, the check is written for $5.6 million. And so incrementally from 14 to 5.6, they have saved $8.4 million for an additional expenditure of $7 million. Okay, then I'd like to, and this might be slightly out of order, but one of the questions that occurs is, well, what happens with net operating losses? And, well, let's back up even more. What in the world's a net operating loss anyway? Well, very simply, if you start with gross value of 50 and back out lease operating expenses, here assuming 1250, and capital expenditures of 60, what you end up with is a net loss, and we commonly refer to that as a net operating loss or an NOL. Now, that can, from month to month, be carried forward and utilized, but at the end of the year, there's still net operating loss at the end of the year. It can be itself converted into a credit. And it's converted into a credit at a rate of 20% to give it dollar-for-dollar equivalency. And what this means is that that also can be sold. So this is another way that the governor's bill and the CS encourages investment, particularly by new entrants into our oil field. And the last person I'm going to talk about for right now is the transition provision. The governor's bill allowed deductions for recent capital expenditures, and that was to look back 5 years and allowable, I believe that's got an error, I think it should be 6 years carried forward. So please note on that slide it should be allowed over 6 years. And the governor's bill also only allowed this deduction when oil was over $40. Now, what is the essence of this? Well, I am not an economist. I am an accountant. And so I can only sort of give you the accountant's view of the world on this. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, in your own business or someone's small business, if a piece of equipment is purchased, depreciation is recognized over its useful life because that piece of equipment is generating income it's got for its useful life. It's not like a pencil that's going to be completely consumed in a year, but it will be generating profits then for a period of time. Under the bill, equipment as a capital expenditure is immediately written off. And so there's no depreciation expense. But what happens then to the capital expenditures that companies invested in the year before this bill is effective, 2 years before, and so on? Well, those assets are still generating profits. And so as a matter of fairness, the governor included this in his bill to, in effect, recognize depreciation expense on those capital expenditures. Now, this transition adjustment was pared down quite a bit in the committee substitute, and rather than allowing 5 years of look-back, the look-back was reduced to 3 months. So, under the CS, it allows cost recovery of assets placed in service from January to March, and that's assuming an April 1st effective date of bill. And it would be deducted equally in each of the next 9 months after the effective date. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Mr. Dickinson to talk about Idea 3.
And actually, Mr. Chairman, can I ask if you have any questions or you just want us to go on and ask questions when we're done?
Good questions. So far. You want to do it now or at the end? Let's go ahead and go to the end then.
Okay. The governor's third big idea here was we ought to be getting a fair share of tax revenues when prices are high, especially if the investment is low. And I think there's a balance here that everyone recognizes. With high prices, we're not getting a fair share. But the flip side is, you know, we should be treated as fairly as other jurisdictions. Look at the kinds of state takes that or government takes that are when prices are high. On the other hand, we have to remain competitive with those entities for investment. I think everyone wants the oil to be lucrative for the state and for the companies. On the other hand, if it's too lucrative for the state, it's not lucrative enough for the companies. And we recognize that there definitely can be competition between jurisdictions. The governor tried to make strike a balance in that area. So what the governor's bill does is it says there'll be a 20% marginal rate on profits, or a 20% rate on profits. After all your costs have been deducted, what's left? The governor bill suggested 20% as the appropriate tax rate, and the CS maintains that general tax rate of 20%, but it adds a progressive feature. This was not in the governor's bill. And what does that progressivity surcharge look like? It applies when oil and the WTI price, which is generally priced about $2 higher than ANS, when the WTI price is greater than $50, or for gas, when the gas price at Henry Hub exceeds $8. There is a surcharge on the oil and on the gas, and then that itself, that just becomes like another tax. It's deductible when you go to calculate your PPT profits. So, the oil surcharge says that for every $10 increase in price, we're going to take 3% of the gross wellhead and add that to the state take. And for gas, it says 2% for every $1 change. And that, you know, the difference in the scale simply is the oil price is moving between, is moving over a much larger range. Now, what happened, and I want to spend a couple of minutes looking at this, is the progressivity feature, it was created in the House there was an original and a CS and then an amendment. And what I'd like to do, if we could spend a minute looking at this graph, is to show you the blue crosses are the original CS. And what that said is, gee, when prices are below $50, the PPT will simply apply, will take 20% of profits. When we go above $50, we will start to take this 0.3% for every dollar, or 3% for every dollar. And what you'll see is that the rate kind of marches up. So if you were at say, $70, there'd be a $20 difference. You multiply that times 0.3, so you get like a 6%. So there'd be a 6% surcharge. And that would keep on going. And in the original bill, that went up until you hit $150. And in fairness, it wasn't people who were sitting here counting what would happen if you went to $150. They were really looking at what happens if you had a sudden spike. You went to $150, and at $150, the progressivity feature would cap out. And at that point, it would be 30% of the gross value at the point of production would be added to the taxes. So you basically had three areas. Once one was below 50, then a transition to when it went up to 150, and in between you had an ever-increasing rate. That was amended, and basically up until $110, it looks exactly the same. But under the amendment, at an average price for a month of $110.01, anything above, this progressivity factor immediately jumps. It more than doubles. You're at a place where it's about 18. In fact, if you think of 110 minus 50 gives you $60 times 0.3 is 18%. It jumps from 18% up to 37.5%. So fundamentally, you go along, you now have three areas. You have the flat area under 50, you have an area up to 110, and then you have a huge jump up, and from 110 on, this progressivity factor adds a separate charge of 37.5% to the PPT. Now, again, if you'll recall when I said this was deductible, and so what happens is that the 37.5%, as you can think of it, 20% of it, because it's deductible, you only think of the after-tax rate on it, so it would be 80%. 80% of 37.5 is 30%. But what you really did is by adding, or what the committee did by adding this progressivity factor is they made sure that the effective amount being added was at 30%, and that it started much earlier when you jumped there. Now, I'm going to take a couple of minutes and walk through that again because there's been a lot of debate about the progressivity factor. It's not something that's in the governor's bill. We think the correct balance was struck. On the other hand, there does seem to be a lot of focus on these progressivity pieces. So what would happen under the governor's bill? There was no progressivity piece. I've just put some of these elements in here so you can see how they line up with the next slide. But You have an ANS for $68 in this example. Your downstream transportation costs are $7, so you drop down to $61 wellhead value. At that point, you go and you look at the cost of getting the oil out of the ground. That's another $7, and so you're down, in this example, to a production tax value of $54 a barrel. You take 20% of that. 20% of 54 is $10.80, and so that would be the tax on each barrel, $10.80. And you can look at it as a percentage of the net, that's 20%. As a percentage of the gross, as a percentage of the same thing we're taxing, for example, that one to the ELF, it's only 17%. Now, I'm going to probably flip back and forth between these two slides, but if you go on to the next slide, you'll say, how would this work under the House Resources Committee substitute? Let's start with a WTI price of $70, and like I said, generally that implies an ANS price of about $68. The PPT calculation looks the same in the beginning. You take 68, you minus 7, your wellhead value of $61, same as we were on the last slide. But instead of going and subtracting only $7 from it for your wellhead, we have this thing called the progressivity amount. Where did that come from? Well, that came from the next column over. Because the price, the WTI price, was above $50, this progressivity element kicked in. So we had a WTI price of 70. We take this, the ANS price of 68, subtract the $7 of transportation, so we have a wellhead value of $61, and we take 6% of that for the progressivity feature. Where does the 6% come from? As you recall, you took $70, the WTI price, you subtract $50 from it, that's set in the statute, so you got $20 of, windfall of extra dollars. You take 3% for each $10. So if you got $20, that's 6%. 6% of $20 is, three percent of the $20 is 6%, and then you take 6% of the $61, and you come out with $3.66 as this progressivity amount. Every barrel is going to pay $3.66 more. On the other hand, when you're calculating the PPT base rate, you get to subtract the 366. So you subtract the 366, you subtract your $7 that we had in our prior example, and you come out with a production tax value of $50.34 for the PPT. And then if you turn to the next page, you will see you take that $50.34, you take 20% of it, and you come out with $10.07 for the baseline tax. And again, if we flip back two pages, that compares with the fact that we had $10.80. So the PPT amount is a little bit less. But then when we go and we look at the progressivity factor, we have to add that $3.66 to the progressivity factor. So the total tax is $13.73. So what we've done is, or what the CS does, is in these high prices, it lowers because it creates this progressivity factor, charges that, the base rate tax goes down a little bit, but the progressivity piece goes up, and so you have a higher rate, a higher effective rate. And if you look on the two numbers on the lower right-hand side of the slide, what you will see is the percentage of the net has now gone from 20% up to a 25.4%. So basically at $70, we've gone up and we've hit about a 25% rate. If you go back and you want to compare that to the ELF tax based on the percentage of the gross value, you will see that that's going up to 22.5%. And again, Mr. Chairman, I know these ran through a lot of numbers here, but I think this progressivity feature is an important distinction from how the governor's bill works, and I hope folks will spend some time looking at how it operates and seeing if that's how they want this to work. And with that, that's all I have on the rate.
Moving on then to some various other provisions included in the governor's bill. The monthly filing is not something that's changing from our current practices. Production tax returns are due monthly. So the original bill maintains the monthly filing, as does the CS. Under the governor's bill, One of the options is to look at expenses yearly, and so may require some estimates for a monthly filing. And so what the governor envisioned here was a 90% payment safe harbor, similar to what happens with your personal income tax returns when you make estimated tax payments. You're not required to pay every last cent on a quarterly basis, but there are some safe harbors that protect you from penalties. And so in the governor's bill, there was a 90% safe harbor provision, and then a yearly true-up on March 31. And that remained the same in the CS. The spill fee. The governor's bill did not change the spill fee. But under the CS, although the total remains the same, the split is different. That is, we've got two parts of the spill fee. One is currently under AS 4355-201, which is currently 2 cents. Under the CS, that would be changed to 1 cent. And the part that is assessed under AS 4355-300, which is actually the amount that's paid, currently is 3 cents, and that is changed to 4 cents. So as you can see, the total remains the same, but the collected fee does rise a penny under the CS. And although under the governor's bill, that spill fee was creditable against PBT, under the CS, it is not. A couple of additional provisions under the CS. The SB 185, that is the current expiration credits under 4355-025 currently. By the way, that provision currently allows for either a 20% or a 40% expiration credit. That will become an alternative credit under the PPT. So a taxpayer could choose the 20% under the PPT, or if the conditions are met, under 025 to get a 40% credit. The CS does extend that for 10 years, because at this point it's sunsetted. Under the CS, a private royalty oil tax rates would be set at 5%, not 20. And on the 90% safe harbor under the CS, the 90% was not changed, but under the CS there would be a penalty if the 90% was not met. Whereas under the governor's bill, it was just an issue of interest. And the other significant change under the CS is that the effective date was moved from a July 1st, 2006 to being effective April 1st, 2006. So in conclusion, we see the PPT is a tax for Alaska's future. It would leave us competitive in the world oil marketplace. It would have high oil development incentives. It increases Alaska's share at high oil prices. And gives a fair split of oil company profits. And that concludes our presentation.
That's good. Are there any questions? Robin or Dan, Representative Meyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple. I know Representative Weirach had one, too. I'm sure you mentioned this, but what is the safe harbor again, the 90% safe harbor?
Chairman Meyer, the idea there is that there's estimates used on a monthly basis, and so rather than have the producer have to pay, you know, every last dollar, that there's sort of a safe harbor. So if 90% is paid, then there's no interest or penalty.
Okay, gotcha. And if I may, I know this is a I know you're concentrating just on the House bills, but One thing that's caught my interest a little bit is in the Senate resources, they talk about a two-for-one as far as dealing with the look-back. Can you describe that and what that is and how that relates to maybe what we currently have in this bill?
Chairman Meyer, the way that works is in the governor's original bill, we looked at 5 years of expenses, and then those could be reclaimed over 6 years. What they did in the Senate is they said, okay, let's look at, we'll still allow that to happen, but for every dollar that you reclaim, you have to be spending $2 in that recapture period. So just, I'm going to use very broad numbers here, but roughly speaking, over this time period, we were averaging $1 billion of spending every year. So what the Senate bill would require is during the look-back period, I believe it's 7 years, but I'm not quite sure on that, but you would essentially require almost like $1.7 billion a year to be spent for that deduction to be taken. So it basically says, yeah, if you made investments, we'll recognize them going forward, but only if you're a continual investor.
Okay. Very good. Following up on that a little bit, if your goal is to try to get more and more money invested in the state, which obviously the more you're investing, sooner or later you're going to find oil and gas, and if your overall objective is to try to keep more oil and or gas in the pipeline, I'm just thinking out loud here, would a proximity work for like investments? In other words, if a company normally invests $700 million a year, let's say for every 100 or 200 million, they go above their norm, then you could give them a, I don't know, 23% credit, and then if they go up to a billion, they get 25% credit. Would something like that work?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, whether it would work, you know, you could certainly do that administratively. I think the issue that arises is how much additional, you know, would that incent more investment or not? I don't know. My suspicion is at some point having simple rules that folks can look at and they can use, and it takes a couple of years before this sort of passes on to the cultures through the companies to say, okay, yes, it makes more, we can move money to Alaska, we invest it there, or we'll reinvest there. You know, I don't believe that the difference between 20, 22, and 23 will be as material in effect as perhaps the difference in, you know, going from 0 to 20, or having making cleaner rules that includes everything that's invested, as opposed to going and saying, well, we don't want to pay for this or we don't want to pay for that. So in general, I think the broader, you know, the more of the costs, the bigger the effect the costs have on their what they have to pay to the state, the more effect they will have in affecting that decision. I'm not sure that raising the marginal rate is the best way of doing that. But you know, there's no reason you couldn't do that.
Can I follow up on that, Mr. Chairman?
Mark.
When the House Resources were talking about proximity on the price of oil, that the tax would go up, did they talk at all about the credit going up with the price of oil? In other words, if the price of oil goes up to the 70, then you know you would go up to 3% or whatever that number is that they're going.
Chairman Meyer, you'd have to ask the sponsor tomorrow. I don't recollect that discussion off the top of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I'm curious, why is not the price, as the price moves up, why isn't that sufficient? When the price moves from $30 per barrel to $60 per barrel, why isn't that sufficient incentive to have more capital invested in the field? Why does it require a clawback provision, or whatever kind of provision we want to call it? Why is that required if, in fact, if I personally know that I'm investing more capital because my prices I'm getting for my products greater, I mean, that pushes capital into the system to get more investment. So why isn't that sufficiently incentivizing companies to do so?
Representative Holm, through the chair, the problem is when oil prices are high, every place is equally incentivized. So when prices are high, industry in general wants to produce, you know, wants to be producing more at high prices, wants to be making productive investments. So the question really is, you know, what we're really doing is competing for companies' investment dollars. So we're taking dollars that they generate here or dollars they generate elsewhere and trying to figure out where they should be invested. And what we're trying to do is change Alaska relative to other regimes. But, you know, rising tide lifts all ships type argument, I think. If you look at the last 3 years, when we have had very high prices, you certainly haven't seen a direct response in investment increases. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up on that point. And so that is my question, and I agree with you. We haven't seen it, and we also do not see it in the long-term investment models that these companies that are up there right now are talking about. You don't see a tripling of investment in new oil production or whatever. They're trying to clean up their act within the fields or within, as I understand it, but they're not going out trying to find new pools of oil to fill that pipeline, which is, as I understand it, we're trying to keep that 6% reduction and leveling that off, so it's maybe 3% or whatever. So we want to incentivize people to put more straws in the ground. But I'm not convinced that what we're doing, and I guess this is why we have all these meetings, I'm not convinced that what we're doing is going to incentivize the oil companies to put more straws in the ground any more than the price of the oil being run, the run-up on the price, should be incentivizing them in our area. So what makes us better than just the price of oil coming up?
Representative Holm, through the chair, if I might just quarrel with two of your assertions in that question before I answer. The first one is, I think some companies are going out and actively exploring. I think you'll see that, for example, Anadarko and ConocoPhillips are producers at Alpine, and they're also pushing that frontier further west and exploring. I think a company like BP, for example, ExxonMobil in Prudhoe Bay, what they're trying to do is get the fields they already know about but aren't producing, getting those in the pipeline. So I'm just going to, you know, A, there are some companies exploring, and B, there are other ways of getting oil in the pipeline other than through exploration. The second point I want to say is I know there have been folks that have come here and pitched a 6% rate of decline, and I would have you look at it. I think it's smaller than that, and we can get together and compare numbers later if you want, but it's a number I wouldn't use. Now let me answer get to your real question, if I might, sir. Mr. Chairman, I think again what I'm going to answer is the what we've got to do has to change Alaska relative to other places. I'm not going to pretend that all their decisions are made based on taxes, but I do believe that Alaska is unique, practically unique in the world, of not creating a system that says if you earn a dollar here and you invest it here, you get to invest a 100-cent dollar, and if you take it out and invest it in Azerbaijan, you only get to invest a 50-cent dollar there because we're going to take the difference. Alaska is unique in not creating systems that encourage reinvestment in the state as opposed to exporting profits made here. And in that sense, if profits are generated when prices are high, dollars are going to flow to places where those restrictions are, and they're going to leave places where those restrictions aren't. So all other things being equal, rocks being equal, I believe that the fiscal system is partially responsible for the lack of investment. I'm not saying that when this occurs, 1,000 flowers will bloom, the pipeline will be full tomorrow. But
it speaks my language. Flowers are going to bloom.
Fertilizer, right?
There you go.
Yeah. I do think that the fiscal system can make a difference, and the state has not protected its interests the way some other oil provinces have.
Thank you.
You said it yourself, Representative Holm, fertilizer. Ben, I guess we're on that subject. What is the normal depreciation schedule on oil field production equipment? Is there a 5-year, 10-year? I know it can range dramatically depending on what equipment is.
If you're going to just a minute.
And while you're looking it up, I guess I would press that with a question is, I want to look back 5 years on the fallback division, but we know that in this five-year time frame, the depreciation has already been taken to some extent on each piece of equipment that's been put into any of the fields. So is there mathematically an equation that you guys have used to look at why we would want to have already depreciated out equipment, but yet in turn around and give the industry a full 100% write-off on the clawback period?
Mr. Chairman, your original question about the depreciable lives, federally, I mean, it varies depending on the category of equipment, but things like vessels, barges, and other water transportation is 10 years. That's not in the field, but it's in the area of oil and gas equipment. Pipelines, 15 years. Offshore drilling, 5 years. And equipment for exploration and production, including drilling, gathering, pipelines, pumping equipment, separation equipment, and certain platforms, is 7. So that sort of gives you an idea of kind of the range.
That was what again? I'm sorry, I was trying to write.
I would say the general category there is 7 years, and it's equipment for exploration and production, including drilling, gathering pipelines, pumping equipment, separation equipment, certain platforms. So that seems to be sort of the general group. And then I read you some other categories of specific oil field equipment.
Well, see, I would think that there'd be some type of pro rata agreement there that, you know, offshore is the closest to it at 5, but I don't know how much has been invested in vessels. You'll be looking at 10 years, so 5 years of the depreciation is taken out already. So you're already down to basically 50% of the value. And if that's the case, why would we, or why would the governor, I guess, propose writing off 100% of depreciated equipment that's already been depreciated 50% that they've already received a write-off on?
Well, Mr. Chairman, certainly that could be a choice to allow a depreciated value. That's certainly a valid choice. The governor took a look at it and felt that his view of fairness was the five-year look back. You know, you could look back further, you could look back less. It was a choice, and clearly, you know, the legislature will make that determination.
Okay. Representative Rodrock, did you have a question?
Oh, sure. Thank you. How and why on the $73 million annual allowance, why was that figure picked?
Through the chair, Representative Weirach, that was a choice. It could have been 70, it could have been 75. The 73 was calculated, I think, at $200,000 a day. And so, again, it's, you know, a degree of arbitrariness.
For a year.
$200,000 per day.
Representative Rock, if I could just flash. Actually, I'm not sure if Mr. Marks is going to be covering that in slides or the 73. Anyway, if you could take just as a ballpark figure, take $50 oil $40 oil at 5,000 barrels a day, would generate $200,000 a day, and $200,000 a day times 365 generates $73 million.
All right, thank
so,
you.
That's
the other question is your chart 36. That was the progressivity feature that went straight up. And you were discussing in terms of the I think $150 barrel scenario.
Representative, through the chair, the 150 was the original CS, mm-hmm. which was then amended so that the if I can do it here, the lighter blue, I mean,
is the original lease, and the break point on that was at $150. The amendment has a break point at $110.
Oh, I see.
The darker triangles.
So the slope of that lower line then is, I can't believe it, is really what we're talking. The slope
that one.
It's quite a bit steeper in the lower line.
Representative, through the chair, the slope of the two lines between $50 and $110 is identical.
I see.
And then what happens is, in the original, that slope continues on up for another $40, the range of $40. In the amendment that you have in the bill that you finally was passed to your committee, it simply jumps from 18 up to 37.5.
Okay. And then you gave a pretty good discussion of that, the difference between the governor's original bill and the progressivity provision that was added in the analysis. Do you have that in writing, so I can read that, so I don't have to rely on my memory? Anywhere in a memo or anything on the distinction?
Not that I'm aware of,
okay.
Through the chair.
Right. But you're going to rely on our memories.
We can certainly.
And then finally, the big ideas that you presented, isn't there a big idea that, or maybe you mentioned it, I didn't hear it, that we want to have a tax rate in 488 to lay the bed for gas contract?
Representative Wyra, through the chair, I think that's correct, but I think the notion there is part of the third bullet, which is to say that we need to be we need to be getting a fair value, and fair is one that's going to encourage future investment, and certainly the gas line is a huge future investment.
Isn't it correct, though, that whatever we do in here is going to be referred to in the contract, so what we're doing here is going to become part and parcel of the gas contract?
Representative Wyra, through the chair, I don't think there's any mystery to the fact that the producers have asked for a degree of fiscal stability on oil as well, and so what will be here will form part of that. I think it is the governor's belief, and I hope you will look at it, that this should stand on its own, as well as be capable of being integrated into a contract through some method.
Mr. Chairman, finally, through the chair. If we adopt 488, we'll be able to, and we're talking about ways to measure reinvestment, because I think reinvestment is a critical component of what we're doing here. If we adopt 488, will we be able to assess the reinvestment later to see if actually there are reinvestment and returns to the state to be able to qualify that, quantify it?
Representative Wyra, for the chair, I would very much hope to do that. Now, this is all private information, and we have our estimates of what is there. But we could, it certainly would make sense to come back and look at that and see if we thought, among the other factors, the things that change in the world, this in fact has done the job we expected it to do. Fair point.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dickinson, I believe you touched on this a moment ago, but I believe you said that something to the effect that we're producing around 870,000 barrels a day, and that by 2016 the drop would only be down to 770,000 barrels per day. Did I remember you to say that correctly?
Representative Holm, through the chair, no, I that doesn't sound. That certainly doesn't sound in line with our forecast.
Well, that's what I heard, but maybe I didn't hear you correctly. Can you give me an idea what the number would be in about 2016? Because it's my understanding that that's about when we're estimating that the gas line could come on board, all the little beans falling in the right little holes.
Representative Holm, through the chair, if you'll excuse me a minute, I'll see if I can get that number.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess what my point is here, and while he's digging around there, my point is here, is that sounds to me that's a pretty minimal drop in terms of how many barrels per day we're getting out of here compared to what I've been told beforehand, between 3 and 6%. And we're trying to minimize it. We're trying to set it down to 3% reduction per year. 2 years, of course, if it was a 30% reduction
just on a straight line, you'd be down somewhere around 500,000 barrels a day. So if it's that high, if you predict that it's going to be that high, and I guess I'll let you answer. I have another question for you.
Representative Holt, for the chair, you know, I would say looking at this, just trying to read off a graph that is about 700,000.
Well, if you roughly do the numbers at $30 a barrel, 900,000 barrels per day, and $60 barrel oil at 700,000 barrels a day are kind of a wash. So I guess my question is, as much as anything, is why the urgency, if that's true? If, in fact, we're not dropping as rapidly as I've been led to believe, if the field is not declining as rapidly as I've led to believe, why is there an urgency to put more straws in the ground and get more oil in as quickly as we possibly can?
Let's have home through the chair. Two things. There's an urgency to get investment because it takes 5, 6, 7 years lead time for the decision being made, the investment being made, longer if there's actual exploration involved. And so as we look out, the notion is you need the lead time to make the investment. And secondly, I think you know, if you look at the current values and volumes, if we were at historical values with today's volumes, we would see a huge drop in revenues below those that even were considered catastrophic in, say, 1999. So I think the urgency is, folks talk about getting the pipeline full again. That may be based on finding an element, but the notion of stopping the decline and keeping the production level will require investment now to keep us in the 800,000, 900,000 barrel range out 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess as a follow-up, if I could. So what you're telling me, then, if I'm reading this correctly, is that we won't see any increase particularly anyway. It's going to take 5 years for them to get it into their program prior to the time that we really are going to see an upswing in production?
Representative Holt, for the chair, I mean, that's correct. There are kinds of things, debottlenecking, there are kinds of investments that they might say make sense, but certainly, I don't think anyone anticipates a huge rush. We're talking about leveling out the level of decline to where it's flat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple also 50,000 foot flyover questions. We're certainly not going to be getting into the nitty gritty here. There's a lot of detail to flush, but just from the beginning, the 50,000 foot look see. First query, looking at the CS that came out, and for that matter, even the governor's proposal on the date that these taxes would, the complete change of regime would take effect. Governor's proposal, I believe, was July 1 of this year. The CS before us now has that date pulled back to April 1st. Yes,
4 days.
That would be the one. Do you, in the department, anticipate being able to have the implementation? Well, actually, could you comment on the amount of regulation that's going to be required to implement either one of these tax regimes, and whether you can have those regulations prepared prior to the act taking effect, and maybe a comment on whether we should have regulations in place, or would it be better to have regulations in place before we ask taxpayers to comply, or do you feel comfortable saying, trust me, well, we'll regulate this 6 months after it takes effect?
To the chair, Representative Hawker, I'll answer your question and invite Mr. Dickinson to add to
this
it.
This is for my testimony earlier in this committee this year where I said, trust Robin, comes back to haunt me.
Well, two things. One is that there's a provision to allow the producers to pay on the current system to allow us some time to get those in place. And two, when I go over the fiscal note, which I expect at this point will be tomorrow, but you'll see that we've built in some expenditures to get us help to get those regulations out quickly. So those are sort of the two pieces of it. It's not an ideal situation from an administration standpoint. I don't think that, I personally don't believe that a 4-1 effective date is really much worse from an administration standpoint than a 7-1. I can't imagine I can get many more regulations written in that period of time. But
I can conclude from that they're equally bad dates. I used to have a CPA after my name too, and it's truly how sophisticated, how complicated, how much regulation is going to have to be developed to implement just this generic concept.
Through the chair, Representative Harker, although the current body of law and regulation is maintained for wellhead value, I do think there'll be a fair amount of regulation writing for around, you know, direct, ordinary, necessary, the allocation of overhead. There's some key pieces that are going to need some regulation writing, certainly. And if you'd like to add to that.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, Representative Harker, again, just to clarify, what the CS says in front of you is that for the first 6 monthly payments that have to be made, you can pay based on the old ELF system. On the 7th payment, you have to true up for those prior 6 months with no interest, no penalties. So there's a recognition that you don't have to be writing checks not knowing what they're about. Now, if you have to be accruing it, not knowing what it's about, certainly that's a fair point. I think, you know, part of the sense is that while prices are high, the state is not getting a fair share, and therefore some of the urgency is to put those in place. But clearly, while we're focusing on the investment and the lead investment, we need to write the regulations that you've spoken about. What I'd like to draw your attention to is 2 items in here which we hope will be huge cost savings and energy savers and also regulation, help us in writing regulations. One of them, as Ms. Wilson referred to earlier, allows us to use some of the work the Department of Natural Resources is doing and rely on that instead of not replicating that. The second one is to take the agreements that are in place on the North Slope right now. Let's take Prudhoe Bay as an example. Right now, you know, BP is the operator, but they only own 26% of the field. So every dollar they spend, ConocoPhillips is actually paying 37 cents of that, and ExxonMobil is paying 37 cents of that. And there's essentially a group whose job is nothing but auditing those monthly bills. There are folks who work for ConocoPhillips, there's folks who work for Exxon, they represent the other minority owners, and all they do is look over BP's shoulders and say, not this, not that, not that one. What our hope is that we can rely on that. Our ability, what we'll do is we will look in, we will make sure that agreement, they're still under an agreement which there are arm's length transactions going on, we'll make sure that they're still effectively monitoring those, and if that's the case, then what we hope to do is not reinvent their wheel, but rely on those. So I believe that for some of the major fields on the North Slope, like Kuparik, like Prudhoe Bay, like Endicott, the authority given to us in both bills, both the CS and the governor's bill, says if you can create a situation where you can rely on those and you can create conditions where you can rely on them and you can monitor the fact that you can rely on them, then that's one way of looking at costs. What's going to be more problematic and which will require extensive regulations are how we look at costs in places where you have a sole venture or you have a minority interest that, say, owns 2% that isn't going to be very effective looking at the operatorship. And those, as Representative Hawker has acknowledged, will require regulations. What we have money in the fiscal note for contract work. What we're hoping to do is take firms. There are firms in Texas, Louisiana who do this for a living. It's the niche they've exploited that do working interest owner audits. They represent small operators, you know, folks who can't go out and do all that auditing themselves but want to make sure that they're being dealt with fairly in leases in the lower 48. We hope to bring those folks on board to use them both to build capacity within the division so that we can stand on our own 2 feet after a year or two and to help us write those regulations. We hope we can do that process in 6 months, and then maybe we'll have to be a true-up later on or something, but that's how we look at this problem.
I may continue, sir. I think, and I just think it's just an editorial comment from myself. I appreciate your answer, and there's a place for both. but I think in some ways we're referring to the internal auditing capacity of the joint working structures. I'm not sure that really gets to the issue of having to write the regulations that they have to account to. So I think maybe we, with all respect, I think part A of your answer was to a different question, but part B of your answer was certainly quite valid. On to this, progressivity. You know, progressivity in the fact that the chart happens to be up on the wall behind you again. Clearly, I guess, again, 10,000 foot or 50,000 foot flyover scenario again here. We've obviously, the original resources CS had this linear line, you know, and it was based on the adding this surtax kind of formula thing. And when it came out of the body, all of a sudden it reaches this, there's this magic with a point there at 110, where there's this huge jump up break point. Just generically as regards propulsivity models, is this really, you know, sort of this gross revenue surtax, is this the only mechanism that could be looked at to achieve a progressive structure?
Representative Walker, through the chair, no, there are certainly many around the world, and I think you will see on most oil deals there are going to be progressive pieces that look at prices are very high. Actually, many. I mean, there are many places that want the sovereign wants to take a significant amount of price risk on. So this is not the only one. I think it is fairly typical of I think if you look at, for example, I think Trinidad and Tobago is one very small that I can think of. This models very closely. There are several others. I don't have them at my fingertips, but we can certainly get those to you that this looks like. But there are other models as well.
I think that's kind of a critical point. Speaking of models, is really kind of where I'm going to there. Certainly a numerous approach. In my mind, I can sit here in the back of an envelope and come up with any number of different approaches that have got, I think, intellectual integrity. One of the things that I don't have access to is, I don't have the economic analysis resources, just as an individual legislator, that either the administration or some of the other committees here in the building have. Do you have the internal capability, as we talk about some alternative progressive systems, to be able to model something other than a surtax system like this?
Representative Hawker through the chair, certainly, and Roger Marshall will be in his chair a couple of minutes, and you can start asking to do that. But we our attempt is, as any of these bills come forward, we try to figure out what they mean, and we will continue to do that and report back to you.
Yeah, if I may continue, sir.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you. Same sort of thing again, just in the generic question, as the bill came out, you had the government proposal. It was a flat tax across all possible price ranges that sort of implies there's an equal economic dynamic, at work in the marketplace at $8 a barrel as there is at $80 a barrel. I think we've kind of fleshed out that's, there's some arguments for a progressive system. Likewise, it seems to be, different with the potential of structuring a progressive reward system, a progressive incentive system, as that be the credit side of this. And then, again, you're capable of working, mechanically capable, we've got the resources that can give us some net results answers. I mean, clearly to me, ultimately the net present value of all future cash flows kind of becomes a benchmark measurement. But we've got the resources to help us flesh out some the credit system as well as the revenue system.
Representative Hawker, to the chair, we certainly do. Obviously, when you model that, and we've modeled it, but you start getting very driven by the assumptions you make. And so, if you want comparable to our prior work, you'll take our assumptions, or you'll recommend assumptions you want to see us use. But clearly, the amount of investment is critical.
Just two more questions, sir, if I might.
Representative Hawker.
Sort of that 90% estimated payment provisions, we call it, typically a safe harbor mechanism, where we all know that, month-end accounting cutoffs are difficult to achieve. It's sort of we're on an annual, most businesses are on an annual basis, not a monthly cycle. So we did have, in the governor's bill, the mechanism in there very clearly that said if you make the, your annual monthly payment, now recognizing, as you said, there was also the annualized catch-up, but essentially if you make 90% of your obligation during the course of the year, you've got a safe harbor as long as you pay up the rest on March 31st. I realize I'm oversimplifying a little bit. But and I read that was pretty clear in the governor's bill, or we were, as the bill was introduced, and I'm pretty comfortable with that, because again, that was a very traditional, it's just of common usage, common application, most tax, estimated tax situations. But as I was reading in detail through the revenues, or excuse me, the revenue, that would be you folks, reading through the resources CS, it appeared to me that it actually, if a person did not make their 100% nut every single month, it throws them into being subject to the penalty, the general penalty provisions, and I think it's 0.305 or whatever it is for just our general basic tax structures, rather than providing, you know, a safe, an interest-only safe harbor, but it throws people into the delinquent and penalty provision automatically. Am I reading that right?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, the CS provides that there would be a penalty if the NIDA is not met, and it applies notwithstanding the penalties in 4305-220.
And then Representative Hawker, through the chair, and then between 90 and 100% interest applies. So you're absolutely correct that unless you paid on the nut or over, there would be an additional financial effect.
So we really, I had misspoke there then as I was reading it. Okay, we're still exempted from penalty provisions as long as we're over 90, but between 90 and 100, we do in fact charge interest on any point of underpayment.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay.
In the CS, not
the CS. In the CS, yes. And that was not the case, nor is it the case of the status quo. And then one last question, if I might, sir.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You made a mistake when you objected to having me not withdraw from this debate. Thank you, sir. Appreciate the confidence. Page 26 of the presentation you did. This is the issue of what started out in the administration's version as a $73 million standard deduction, and it's evolved into a $12 million standard credit. And I'm not looking to go into all the details behind this, but when we went from a deduction to a credit, there was just a mathematical consequence here. And do I read this correct? I'm looking at the middle column. That if I invest $5 million capital investment, I am in fact, because of the combined standard credit and CapEx credit, receiving a benefit of $6 million.
So the chair, Representative Hawker, that is correct.
I like that kind of investment. I'm just taking it to another step. For $12 million, best estimates, mind you, this is exemplary. $12 million, I get $14.4 million investment. Or I get a credit of $14.4 benefit for investing $12
million. To the chair, Representative Hawker, that's correct.
I like this. At least if I was on that side of the table. I think we may come back and revisit this before the day is over. Thank you, sir.
Representative Hawker, you have to remember that I can acknowledge you're sitting over there. With that, thank you, Dan. Thank you, Robin. Excuse me. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. If you look at the page 10 part, graph chart, this legacy field began in 98, 99, somewhere in there, to go bow down on the recovery on the severance tax, and shortly thereafter the passengers started screaming. I mean, it was just headed for straight line. Looking at the clawback provision, I could understand that, I guess, if it hadn't been for the Caparic situation. Can you identify, not today, but could you identify the dollars that we forewent by having that poorly anticipated Caparic legacy field result? So that you look at the dollars under the curve on your page 10 there between about 98, 99, where it began to really misbehave. Look at the dollars under the curve out through the current date and let us know what those dollars that we didn't get were. And then I'll adjust my sympathy for the clawback.
Representative Kelly to the chair. So basically, what would happen if there hadn't been an ELF, and what would happen if it...
If the ELF had behaved like a legacy field, which is your next page, top chair,
okay,
instead of diving nose down. And then, I'll reserve my sympathy level adjustment on that clawback, I guess, after I understand what happened there, in dollars. And then maybe this is I suppose it's to come, but was there anything, a look at the 2520 and the progressivity as it relates to the 2020, you folks didn't do that comparison. You did it in verbal in language, but is that'll come ahead, I assume?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, yes, Mr. Marks has a number of slides to go through. I think that will probably hit on what you're interested in there.
Representative Kelly? Just on that, to what Representative Parker said, the adjustment in the progressivity where it goes straight up is an interesting non-typical glass wall. I would think that can adjust behavior. I haven't figured out how, but I would if I were on either side of this thing. So you've got some other, did I hear it correctly that you've got some other ways of doing that that you're going to present, or did you go that, maybe it didn't go that, just so that we can get an idea of a way to, in rate making, anything that jays that dramatically is an enemy of mine, usually. I guess it depends on
the draw.
So anyway, I'd like to look at some other models as well. There. And one last thing, as the bottom of these more progressive curves, as the oil price comes back, they look like leather in the park thing when they come for zero. We don't have here a safety net under this thing, other than just the way the curves behave. Any thoughts on not necessarily putting ELF at the bottom, although that might be one simple way to do it, on a minimum?
With that, Kelly, through the chair, just on your second question, if we can maybe get together and identify exactly what you want to look at, there's a gazillion possibilities. Make sure we understand what you would like us to look at in terms of other progressivity features. But make sure I didn't carry away an open-ended assignment.
Just so I don't make the task larger than I anticipated, I'm just looking at that straight-up behavior there and other models that might smooth that, which is, I think, where Representative Hawker was coming from. I just want to second what he's saying and see whatever you produce for him. I'm interested in that.
Mr. Kraft. And totally spacing on your third question.
The ELF type floor.
Right, excuse me, thank you. And we, in fact, looked at that, and some of the early drafts had a floor in it. But one of the observations that Dr. Van Meers made, and I think it's very true, is that if you're doing a profits-based tax, all a floor ends up being is really a cash flow issue. Because if you're not making any profit but you're paying minimum tax, then it really makes sense that the next year you can reclaim that. It becomes part of the deduction. So it really just becomes a very administratively complex way of taking an interest-free loan from the producers and paying it back when profits are higher. And so his observation was, if we're going for profits, and recall again that first graph, at minimum we have royalties which are based on wellhead value, we have income taxes, we have property taxes that are not price sensitive at all. So at low prices, even if the production tax goes to zero, and recall the way these are set up, you can't go below zero. We're not writing checks for things. Actually, in the CSUR, there's a limited ability to actually have refundable credits. But in general, we're not. The notion is that that's just going to go to zero, and when profits are high, we'll be taking some. So neither this bill nor the CS has that minimum tax in it.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just a moment.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. If I might suggest, we're just finished with the resource committee, and we had about 95 questions presented to us. And so we are, very committed to getting all the questions answered and answered quickly and appropriately. If I might suggest or encourage everyone to write down your questions and with the permission of the chair, perhaps route the questions through the chair, and just so that, you know, we all understand what questions are being asked and that they will all, that we don't miss any. So that would obviously be up to the chairman, but that would be my recommendation.
Through the chair, just a very quick response to Representative Kelly's dialogue across the table here. I very much look forward to spending some time on fleshing out a couple of alternative progressivity mechanisms here. Again, this is this whole issue, is I now analyze it as a circumstance where there's no correct answer to anything, but there are certainly some wrong answers. And I think, you know, that's where we're headed to divine, and I'm truly looking forward to working with the committee on those points.
Thank you, Representative Toole.
Thank you.
I apologize for being late, Mr. Chairman. I had to present downstairs. But
I understood you had to deal out and how important it is.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
But as I was going through your presentation, I noticed that it isn't until page 40 or so where you address the issue of the effective date of the bill. And in the context of the clawback for 5 years, and I was looking at the three points of why we want to do this. We want to maximize what the state gets when oil prices are high because the system is broken, et cetera, et cetera. You've gone over all of that. And I'm wondering, we're willing to give the industry a 5-year clawback. Why weren't we willing to also give the state a clawback to, say, January of 2006?
Representative Jewell, through the chair, I think, you know, the governor's focus was on getting investment. That getting investment is very important because that's how many barrels are going to be produced. When people made investments, they might have expected those investments to be productive over 4, 5 years, 10 years. They didn't make the investment expecting to recoup at $60. They have recouped at $60. You can make an argument that all those costs have been recovered. But the point is, what you don't want to do is set up a situation where somebody says, gosh, you know, if I just waited a year to invest, I won't feel like a fool. I'll feel like a fool if I make the investment, I don't get anything. If I invested a year later, I would have gotten 20 or 30% tax credit on it. So I think having a transition provision always makes sense, and I think a transition provision that doesn't leave somebody feeling like they you know, the rules might change again, they might be left isolated, is important. So I understand the math of what you're saying, and it's a fair point, but I want to say the governor's answer to that, Mark, not put words in his mouth, but I think his focus was on the investment, having transition rules, so when you change the rules, you sort of always understand those conditions. And I think that's how you balance those two.
More other questions? Thanks again, Dan. Thanks, Robin.
Yes, and I would just make one further note before Mr. Mark steps up. And that is, just today I saw the sponsor statement that's attached to the CS. I do note in the first paragraph there's a couple of numbers that need to be changed. I'd like to discuss that further tomorrow when we present the fiscal note.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Marks.
I'll get a little coffee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Marks. I'm a petroleum economist with the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. And what I'll be presenting today is some qualitative or quantitative analysis of some of the PPT issues surrounding the governor's bill, the status quo in the House CS. So what you get is 2 hours of accounting followed by 1 hour of economics. So who says you have a thankless job? As an overview, broken the presentation into 7 pieces. One, first, a description of the tax itself. I think that was covered pretty well in the prior presentation, so we'll gloss over much of that. We'll do a description of our model and our how we see the long-term cumulative revenues, annual revenues, what the effective tax rate looks like, what the state take looks like under again, we'll compare the status quo of the governor's bill and the LCS. And finally, we'll have a look at how the legislation may affect Cook Inlet. And I may take some opportunities to digress on some of the issues presented in the prior presentation. Actually, just again, I don't think we really need to spend the time to go over how the PPP works and the tax works. So we'll just pass over that because I think that's been covered in enough detail. Take a couple notes about the progressive surcharge. Again, this was covered in the prior presentation, how it works. Again, here you see the jump up that occurs at $110.01. I think that should give people pause about whether that's really what you want to do. The progressive surcharge is based on WTI, West Texas Intermediate. West Texas Intermediate is a lighter crude than ANS. It's about 34 degree API gravity. ANS is about 27 degrees. WTI is priced in the Gulf. ANS is priced in the West. Nevertheless, they correspond fairly close to each other over time. If you look at them under a difference under a microscope, however, you see that the difference between WTI and ANS actually can jump around quite a bit. In the time frame in this slide between January 88 and January 06, WTI has averaged about $2.30 more than ANS, but you see it's been anywhere from about 50 cents above to 650 above. In beginning of 05. In our modeling, we used a $2 difference in our modeling for that to model the progressive surcharge. Again, I will skip the example how the PPT works. I think that we went through enough difficult, and we'll start out in how our modeling works and discuss one of the important aspects of modeling how much money we'll get from these proposals, and that's on the issue of volume. That's how much oil is there going to be? That's important and also difficult to forecast. As we thought about modeling the volumes, we looked at two sets of parameters. One is whether or not there was a gas line. With a gas line, what you get are three effects. First, Prudhoe Bay volumes would diminish initially because of the reduction in reservoir pressure from voiding gas out of the reservoir, but you would get extended field life at Prudhoe Bay. Second, it's an open question whether you can develop the Point Thompson field without a gas line. It's under a lot of pressure. If you start extracting liquids out of the reservoir, it's very costly and expensive to re-inject the gas, and a lot of people, including unit operators, believe at this point the most efficient way to produce Point Thompson would be to produce the liquids at the same time as the gas. So in our modeling, we've assumed that with the gas line, you also get the Point Thompson field. In addition, the gas line would be built to carry about 50 TCF of gas. About 35 of that is discovered now between Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. The producers believe another 15 TF could be found and will be found. With that, there would also be oil discovered as well. So with a gas line, you get an extra 700 million barrels produced between when the gas line would start around 2015 and 2050. The other parameter affecting volumes is whether or not you'd have a scenario where there are enhanced volumes, whether ANWR comes on, whether there's extensive heavy oil development, whether MPRA comes on. So we also have a scenario with enhanced volumes. So what we have at a gas line, what we've done is sort of for this presentation have the bookends. What we have is a low volume scenario with no enhanced volumes and no gas line, and that pretty much represents the volumes in our revenue source book, which includes volume, which includes reserves in development, under development, and under evaluation at prices of about $20. It includes no new discoveries. And then we have our high volume scenario, which includes the gas line and the enhanced volumes. In the low volume scenario, we have about 5.7 billion barrels through 2030, of which about 0.6 billion barrels are heavy oil. And we have no additional heavy oil or no additional investment for heavy oil at prices under 30. With the high volume scenario, we have 10.5 billion barrels. Under the low volume scenario, we assume without a gas line and without enhanced volumes, the North Slope would shut down in 2030. With the high volume scenario, we looked at that through 2050. That has 10.5 billion barrels, of which 3.1 billion of the additional barrels are conventional, and 1.7 billion of the additional barrels are heavy oil. This is a graph of how the two scenarios look. Again, the low volume scenario cuts off in 2030. The high volume scenario, we carried it out to 2050. The wiggles in the line that you see in the high volume scenario represent a series of 8 different fields we have coming on 4 years apart, starting in 2018. In terms of the economic assumptions in the models, on the cost side, we have some good data for our costs. We have access to federal income tax returns. We have access to the property tax assessments. We have access to special studies and annual reports. This data has cost data has not been audited, because right now the way our tax structure works, those are not deductible, and so we don't audit them. So they are subject to uncertainty. What we assumed based on our data, in terms of exploration, we had $100 million a year exploration costs going through 2040. In terms of ongoing capital costs for all oil, it's $1 a barrel. On existing conventional oil, we had $3.50 a barrel on two-thirds of the barrels. Now, the reason we structure it that way is on existing fields now, much of the oil that's going to be produced depends on new investment. If you stopped investing now on the existing fields, the decline curve would plummet like a rock. And again, this was one of the reasons for what we call the callback provision in the governor's bill, is that much of the investment that's occurred is not to get oil today or tomorrow, but it's to get oil down the road, and some of those investments could have been deferred. And that was the reason for having the transition provisions. On heavy oil, we used $8 a barrel developmental capital on two-thirds of the barrels for the same reason. On new conventional oil, $3.50 a barrel. On new heavy oil, $8 a barrel. On operating costs, $3 a barrel for conventional oil and $5 a barrel on heavy oil. Now, are these numbers going to be correct down the road? No, of course not. They're estimates. They could be high and they could be low. In terms of sensitivities, if the numbers were off $1 a barrel, if the ongoing capital was off $1 a barrel and the developmental capital was off $1 a barrel and the operating costs were off $1 a barrel, if all those were off $1 a barrel, so you were $3 a barrel off, that would affect revenues per the governor's PPT bill about $200 million a year, up or down. And so what we should recognize going into this PPT structure with the upstream costs being deductible, it subjects us not only to price volatility like we've always been subjected to, but cost volatility as well. In this analysis, all costs, prices, and revenues are in real 2005 dollars. When we go out to 2030 or to 2050, if we use inflated dollars, what happens is much of the effects we see are purely attributable to inflation, so we just took inflation out of the picture. On the price side, for the heavy oil, we discounted that 8% for quality, and further modeling assumptions. The $12 million credit allowance per company, the analysis we've done suggests that we estimate there'd be about 10 full company equivalents taking that allowance. So the revenues have been reduced to $120 million a year to reflect that allowance. That allowance expires after 10 years per the provisions in the House CS. I'll take my first digression here. The issue came up about, how does this $12 million credit relate to the $73 million allowance that was in the governor's bill. The original intent of the $73 million allowance was to reflect something in the current tax code. Under the current tax code, most small fields would pay zero tax because of the ELF. And as a way to encourage small investors and new investors, we tried to replicate that effect in the governor's bill. We think having small companies in the state is important. It offers diversification. It offers new ideas. They also tend to be less risk-averse than big companies, so you're going to get more exploration. In addition, we believe small companies would explore new areas besides the North Slope. We don't think they're equipped to go into the North Slope so much, but in terms of the areas like Nanana Basin or the Southern Foothills, we think the small companies have a bigger appetite for that. So that was the original reason for having the $73 million allowance per company, which, given the 20% tax rate, came into a $14 million tax reduction each year, assuming they had $73 million in income to deduct. And then in the House, that was changed from a deduction to the $12 million credit. And then they can only take that credit insofar as they have $12 million in qualified capital expenditures. We talk a little bit about what is not modeled, what we call feedback effects. These are some of the issues that I think Representative Holm alluded to in the last presentation. Is how do we know how much new investment we're going to get? Can we model this? Well, we know tendencies, and economists are not very good at forecasting the future. They're pretty good at explaining what happened in the past and why people did things, and they're pretty good at explaining tendencies. But in terms of qualifying or forecasting specific quantitative results, they're not so good. And we didn't attempt to do that here because we would have been wrong. And what we really want to represent here is the changes in money we would get purely due to the mechanics of how the tax works. And what are some of those effects? We know production depends on investment, and there's more investment with incentives, and these credits that are in the bill are certainly incentives. And what two aspects of these credits and the cost deductions that should be emphasized for spurring on investment, and how do we know we'll get more investment? Number one, under the current system, you cannot deduct your upstream costs. So you don't reduce your taxes by investing in Alaska. You reduce your taxes somewhere else by taking your profits you make in Alaska and investing them somewhere else where you can deduct them. Under the governor's bill, you reduce your taxes by investing in Alaska. Qualitatively, we believe that will increase investment. Again, we wouldn't want it, it would be heroic to say how much. In addition, provisions in the bills where you can sell your credits and you can convert your losses to credits and sell those. What that does, if you're a new investor or a small investor and come in and incur and make capital expenditures, incur losses early on, incur credits, you can convert your losses to credits and sell your credits on a net immediately, on the same year you incur your capital costs. On a net present value basis, that's very important for investment. And again, that's something that we believe will increase investment because your net present value of monetizing your losses immediately will be important. Again, under these feedback effects, you know, there's more investment with higher prices and less investment with lower prices. Again, as we've looked at different prices, we did not change the amount of investment. Investment is just tied to barrels, the way this model works. On the other hand, we know there's less investment with higher taxes. We're raising the tax rate here. That's going to have a negative impact. And finally, you know, investment is driven by competitive international opportunities, which are always evolving. You had experts coming in here saying, you know, 25-20 is internationally competitive. 5 years from now, who can be sure whether that will be true or not? And so that's another issue that you can't quantify. We know it affects investment. So the first series of numbers we want to show are cumulative revenues. What the revenues look like over time. And again, we're going to look at the low volume scenario without enhanced volumes, without the gas line through 2030, and the high volume scenario with the enhanced volumes and with the gas line through 2050. Now, on the high volume scenario, very important to understand, those do not include the gas line severance taxes. However, the upstream costs from the gas line, particularly the upstream costs for Point Thompson, the upstream costs for yet-to-find fields would be deductible under the PPT. We envision getting our gas line severance taxes through the in-kind gas that we would get through the gas contract. And also very important to understand, when we say the upstream gas line costs are deductible per the PPT, what would not be deductible per the PPT is the conditioning plant and the pipeline itself. So what is deductible is the upstream development costs. So we have not included the gas line severance taxes here because the gas line contract is distinct from the PPT bill and could be in place without it. And so we could have a gas line contract with the status quo oil taxes. Just for reference, with the gas line, uninflated in 2005 dollars, at a $5 price in Chicago, we'd get about $1 billion a year. And so over 35 years, that would be about $35 billion. So looking at the low volume scenario, this is what the cumulative severance taxes would be under the step.
Excuse me.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Could you repeat what you just said?
Starting well. Okay, what is not sound? Here's the low volume, the cumulative severance taxes. Let's talk about what they include and what they don't include.
Well, let's pop up.
The low volume scenario doesn't include the gas line. The high volume scenario includes the gas line. Let's talk about what that includes and what it doesn't include. What that includes as deductible for the PPT is the upstream. In addition to the upstream costs for developing the oil and producing the oil, the upstream costs for developing the gas, specifically the Point Thompson oil field, yet-to-find oil fields, and the operating costs. What it does not include is, what is not deductible under the PPT, would be the cost for the downstream gas treatment plant and the main $20 billion pipeline. Now, what is not included in these revenues is the severance taxes from gas. So what we have, in a way it appears a little biased because we have the cost for the gas but not the revenues. And the reason we've shown it that way is because the gas line contract, we envision the severance taxes from the gas being taken from the provisions in the stranded gas contract. Well, that contract is distinct from this PPT bill, and you could have the gas line contract with the status quo oil. That is why we did not include the gas line severance tax revenues in here, but we included the costs. And again, just for reference, at a $5 price of gas in Chicago, we would get an extra $1 billion a year, the state would. And over 35 years, that's $35 billion. So, hope that's clear.
Okay. Clear as mud.
Low volume.
So going back to figure four, this is our first cumulative sales tax graph. This is the low volume scenario. And what you see are cumulative severance taxes at different West Coast A&S prices over the period fourth quarter 2006 through 2030 at A&S prices ranging from $15 to $65. And the scale on the left is billions of dollars, and these are real 2005 dollars. And so what you see is the bottom graph is the status quo. The middle graph is the governor's bill, and the high yellow line there is the House CS. What are the crossover points with the status quo? With the House CS, it's $24.80. With the governor's bill, it's $27.20. And also, you'll note in this graph there's kind of a bend at about $50, and that's where the progressivity surcharge kicks in under the House CS. We'll talk a little bit about crossover points. Just another pointer here. There's a lot of interest in what the crossover point is, and the crossover point is certainly important, but what's also important is the slope of the line. And what I just want to illustrate in this figure five is an example of how you could have two different hypothetical tax schemes. I call them Plan A and Plan B. For Plan A, you actually have a low crossover point, and you'd say, wow, it exceeds the status quo at a low price. It must make us a lot of money. But because of, for instance, Plan A could be something with a low tax rate but a low credit rate, it could actually have a low crossover point, but it would also have a low slope. And if you compare it to Plan B might have a higher tax rate but a higher credit. You can see where the crossover point from Plan B is actually higher than Plan A, but once you cross, say, $25, you start getting more money from Plan B. So the lesson here is don't pay attention solely to the crossover point, that the slope is important as well. Figure 6 is the cumulative scenarios, the cumulative service taxes for the high volume scenario, and again, this includes those enhanced volumes and the gas line as well. Notice the scale on the left goes up to $100 billion. The previous one went up to 60. That's because we're looking at more oil and we're looking at a longer period of time. But you also notice here that the crossover points are higher. Under the governor's bill, it's $34.20. Under the House CS, it's $30.70. The reason is, again, we have the upstream gas costs here. Again, without the gas revenues, and we also have more heavy oil with the enhanced volumes. So with the heavy oil costs more, it's worth less, so it creates a higher crossover point. Next, look at the annual revenues, how they look. What we did under each scenario, the high volumes and the low volumes, we looked at prices of $20, $40, and $60. Again, in the high volume scenario, that includes the gas line without the gas line costs without the revenues. This figure 7 shows $20 oil and.
Excuse me, Hawker.
That's all right, home, but that's okay.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Chairman. Just one point here. Back on 17, when you talk about annual revenues, when you talk about it does not include, or when we were talking about it, it had the gas line in the under the high volume scenario. You didn't have any money in there for the quote unquote 20% or whatever the percentage would be of in kind. Is that correct?
Right.
And because you don't have that in there, we're still going to assume that that is going to be a part of the whole program. That if a gas line goes in, there will be some kind of participation in kind. Is that what you're
right,
thinking?
Right, and that would be distinct from the PPT. The way the stranded gas contract is structured at this point is we will be taking a percent of the gas in kind, and right. So the gas revenues would. The revenue side would be outside the 20% PPT.
Okay.
In addition, again, keep in mind that with the gas line, you also get additional those additional oil barrels, too.
Thank you.
So this shows what happens at $20 oil. And here we're below the crossover point. At $20, we certainly lose money. There's no question about it. But as we pointed out several times, what is the status quo at $20? The status quo at $20 over this time frame, we average $116 million annually. But right now we're getting $1 billion. And so the point we like to make is at $20 oil, you have bigger problems than having chosen the wrong tax system. At $20 oil, under any tax system you've chosen, you're not going to make very much money off your taxes, and it brings in the issue of a broad-based tax system. So we believe obsessing what happens at low prices is not incredibly fruitful, because no matter what you do, you're going to get a small amount of money at $20. I'll also point out here why the graph shoots up initially, and that's because the effective date is April 1st, and we're looking at the last quarter of FY06 is included in there. So the low point there on that cap curve represents just the last 3 months of FY06. Now, I just want to, I guess, digress a minute for something that came up under the question Representative Joel brought up about if we're going to have a clawback provision for the investments, why shouldn't the state be able to claw back? And again, we prefer to call the transition rules. Again, I hope we made the case that one good reason to have those is that a lot of those expenditures were made to produce oil in the future, not to produce oil the next day. And many of those investments could have been deferred had they known the tax was changing. The problem, as I see it, and the way the administration sees it, and going back, April 1st, it's March 27th, April 1st is 4 days. This bill, I don't think is going to pass in the next 4 days. And so if it's effective April 1st, you have the producers from April 1st onward not knowing what tax system they're under. In business, planning is everything, and we believe, having taxes retroactively or not knowing what taxes you're subject to at the time creates a poor investment climate. So that is the rationale, we believe, for having the effective date being July 1st of 2006. Going on to $40, the annual revenues, the House CS, under the House CS, is $400 million more than the status quo and $100 million more than the governor's bill. You'll note the bump here in 2017. That is when the $12 million allowance provision expires. That's a 10-year provision, so when that expires, there's a bump in revenues of $120 million. You'll note, looking, if you compare the $20 prior graph, where we were losing $100 million a year relative to the status quo, compared to this $40 price, where we're making $400 million more under the House CS, or $300 million more in the governor's bill. At $40, in 1 year at $40, we make up what we lose at under 4 years at $20. Again, another reason probably not to obsess about low prices with this, because again, there are low prices, there are bigger problems. This shows $60. The House CS, $1.3 billion more average per year, more than the status quo, and $400 million more than the governor's bill. Of this amount, this is under the $60 price, you have the progressive surcharge kicking in. That starts out at about half a billion dollars a year, and as production declines, it tapers off to about $200 million over 2030 time period. So the average amount of the surcharge is about $300 million per year in this graph. again, when you're looking at, you know, $1.3 billion more or $1 billion more, depending on which provision you're looking at, again, this is a low-volume scenario without the gas line. What you're getting here is your gas line revenues without the gas line under at current prices. Let's look at the high-volume scenarios, the same three prices, 20, 40, 60. Again, the high volume includes the gas line, but not the gas line severance taxes. $20 still pathetic, whether you're under the status quo or the governor's bill or the House CS. $40, about $300 million more than House CS, $300 million more than the status quo, and $100 million more than the governor's bill. Again, in 2017, you see the bump where the $12 million allowance expires. And here's the $60 price, the House CS, about $1.2 billion more than the status quo, $400 million more than the status quo, or $400 million more than the governor's bill, and again, the progressive surcharge, about $300 million a year, average. Next, we'll talk about the effective tax rate. Again, when we talk about effective tax rate, we want to be very careful with our vocabulary. What do we mean by effective tax rate? Well, how I define it in this presentation, or how we define it, now under the status quo, your effective tax rate is based on what we call, you know, the wellhead value or the net back value or the gross value at the point of production, which is the market price less your transportation costs. And so to look at that on an apples-to-apples basis, under the status quo, your effective tax rate is your ELF times your 15% nominal rate. That's your effective rate. Well, what we want to look at is what's the effective tax rate under an apples-to-apples comparison, where we're looking at under the PPT, the severance tax, the effective tax rate under the PPT would be the severance tax divided by the gross value at the point of production. So this is what it looks like under the low volume scenario. Again, under the status quo, that flat line, your ELFs, no matter what your price is. So what this shows is that if you're looking at it from the perspective at the gross value at the point of production, the governor's bill itself, it doesn't have a progressive surcharge, but your tax as a percentage of your gross value at the point of production is no question, it's progressive. As prices go up, you get a higher and higher percent of the wellhead. Now this is the way the ELF was originally meant to work. The ELF was originally supposed to, just how much money you need, how much money you need to cover your operating costs at a given price, and that was meant to be progressive. This is absolutely progressive as well. This shows the high volume scenario. Looks pretty similar. Again, the status quo is flat. The reason it drops a little bit at $30 is because you have more heavy oil coming in at $30. That's worth a little less. But again, under the governor's bill, the tax rate creeps up as price creeps up to about 12% at $65. The House CS creeps up to about 17% with the progressive surcharge. Next, we're going to look at state take. And again, we need to, in vocabulary, need to define our terms carefully. What we're talking about is the amount of money the state gets. This is severance tax over economic rent. What this is actually all state revenues, severance tax, royalties, corporate income taxes, and property taxes, divided by what we call the economic rent. The economic rent is the profits before tax. And that's what generally economists talk about when they talk about state take, is what percent of the rent. So what we're looking at is what percent of the economic rent the state gets, again, not just the severance tax, through its four bites of the apple, severance tax, royalty, corporate income tax, and property tax. Here's the low volume scenario. And what you'll see is under all three provisions, initially at low prices, we still have what we call a regressive system. And regressive means we get a high percent of the rent at low prices. Well, what we have is a regressive system at low prices that bottoms out. Why is it regressive under all three provisions? Well, it's regressive because of the property, number one, because of the property tax. The property tax is based on the value of property. It has nothing to do with price. So if you have $1 billion in property, your property tax is going to be X regardless of price. Similarly, the state corporate income tax is based on worldwide apportionment. And with the oil companies, their profits depend not only on oil prices, but also their refinery margins. And refinery margins actually happen to do good when oil prices are low. So this provides a hedge to the state in terms of low prices. But what it means is our corporate income taxes kind of stay at a certain level regardless of price. So this is why at low prices we're getting, you know, economic rents close to 100%. But as you get down to, you know, as prices creep up and the effects of the property tax and the corporate income taxes get diluted with higher prices, what happens under the three proposals? Under the status quo, you see the state take actually goes down as price goes up. Again, because the upstream costs are not deductible, and the ELF has nothing to do with price. The governor's bill stays pretty steady. It stays pretty steady at about 33%. And under the House CS, it's a little bit above the governor's bill and starts to increase slightly, especially at $50, where the progressive surcharge kicks in. Here's state take at the high volume scenario. Again, it's pretty much the same picture. Finally, to conclude the presentation, we'll talk about how would the PPP prevention affect Cook Inlet. This is just looking at Cook Inlet. Here's sort of a snapshot of what Cook Inlet looked like in 2005. There were about 8 producers producing both gas and oil, about 19,000 barrels of oil about a day, about 475,000 MCF per day of gas, about 200 BCF a year. And you see their per barrel equivalents. You basically have, you know, 3 or 4 oil producers. Again, compared to the North Slope, this is minuscule. The gas production is fairly significant. You have 3 sizable gas producers: Chevron, Unocal, Marathon, and ConocoPhillips. What can we say about Cook Inlet gas in general? Cook Inlet in general is gas prone. On a barrel of oil equivalent, it's about 80% gas. And dwelling on the oil, because, let me just talk about the oil quickly, because of the $12 million allowance, because a lot of the facilities are fairly expensive to produce down there, we think the PPT impact on oil is not going to be significant. Right now, the ELF on oil at Cook Inlet is zero, has been zero for years, and the analysis we've done suggests the oil taxes would not increase at all or very much. So we'll focus this presentation on the gas side. The Cook Inlet gas industry is evolving, and it's pretty difficult to tell where it's going. And it's evolving on a lot of fronts. One, production is decreasing. A lot of facilities are fairly old. They've been there 30 years. They're paid off. There is some new increased investment there. The LNG plant, it's unsure whether its export permit is going to be renewed by the Department of Energy. That might shut down in 2009. The Agrium plant, it's uncertain whether it can afford to operate at market prices. There's a fear there that if there's a North Slope gas line, that North Slope gas would enter Cook Inlet and sort of take the knees out of producers in the Cook Inlet. So that it's hard to tell, how producers or investors are going to react to that specter. In addition, the price picture in Cook Inlet gas is very uncertain. The RCA recently, the Regulatory Commission, has granted the UNICAL contracts based on Henry Hub prices, which are the market price in the Gulf of Mexico. That is absolutely revolutionary as a way of pricing gas in Cook Inlet. Prior to this, or even at this point in time, Cook Inlet has been a closed market. There were a small number of buyers and a small number of sellers without any outside opportunities, and that's what kept the market mechanism in place. Some economists don't believe the RCA made the right decision in subjecting the prices to Henry Hub, and some think it they did. Probably this is not the setting the end of that, but the point is, what the price picture in Cook Inlet is very uncertain. There's some existing contracts right now that are as low as 65 cents. There's a lot of contracts in the mid $2, and then all of a sudden, I heat my house with gas at Anchorage, and Hurricane Katrina came along, and boom, my gas bills went up, and maybe that's the market, maybe it's not, but it is part of the landscape of Cook Inlet prices. It's hard to tell exactly what's going to happen. So what may happen to Cook Inlet gas as a result of this PPT? We think on existing fields where the infrastructure is fairly old and depreciated and paid off, they may see some increase in tax if indeed they do get higher prices. New fields may see lower taxes if they have new investments and can deduct them and get the credits. In addition, because the ability to monetize losses and credits, they'll see a higher NPV. Now, on these old existing fields that may see higher taxes if they get higher prices, is this a good thing or a bad thing? The existing Cook Inlet gas structure is based on the gas elf. We've talked a lot about the oil elf, but we should also understanding what happens to Cook Inlet gas and what the status quo is, we should understand the gas elf. The gas elf is actually structured much simpler than the oil elf. It's simply 3,000 MCF per well per day is tax-free. As far as Cook Inlet economics are concerned, we think it's a little bit outdated. The ELF structure was promulgated in 1977. Again, the point of the ELF is to be able to recover your operating costs so the tax doesn't make you shut down. Now, in 1977, the price of gas was 65 cents. Well, if you're getting $7 an MCF for your gas now, it stands to reason you don't need as much gas to cover your operating costs at $7 gas than you did when it was 65 cents. Also make one point that the Cook Inlet, the gas elf, which applies to the North Slope as well, has been in place since 1977. And for those who bemoan the lack of fiscal stability in the state, the gas elf has not changed in almost 30 years. And then if you look at, there were changes in the corporate income tax in 1981. And so if you put those together, anyone who produces gas has been under the exact same fiscal structure they are now that they were 25 years ago. Here's a snapshot of what all the fields in Cook Inlet, there are big ones and little ones. The average elf in Cook Inlet is 0.5. Again, which means, if you get 3,000 MCF a day, what that means is the average well in Cook Inlet produces about 6,000 MCF a day. Again, this is basically what I said before. We believe the gas elf does not represent the economics of Cook Inlet Gas, given the way it was set up in 1977 based on the economics then versus the economics now. Now, this is not to say that the gas, that the ELSA as it works on the North Slope for gas doesn't represent the economics. The economics of gas on the North Slope with very high upstream costs and very high downstream costs is nothing like the economics of Cook Inlet. So we're addressing our comments really to how the gas self operates in Cook Inlet. We estimate, now we did not include the impacts on Cook Inlet gas were not included in the fiscal note. Again, the reasons because in terms of materiality, the amount of money pales compared to what happens with the North Slope oil, which is included in the Cook Inlet, which is included in the fiscal note. And again, the amount of uncertainty in Cook Inlet in regard to price and production is significant. But just based on the present data, and again, we don't want to talk about specific taxpayer data, but we estimate the crossover point at about $5 an MCF on existing fields if the PPT were implemented relative to the status quo. And what if it went up to $6? That would be about $25 million more than the status quo on existing fields, and that's out of $1 billion of gross revenues annually from Cook Inlet Gas. And that, you know, that $25 million would decrease as production goes down. And again, new production in Cook Inlet, because of the deduction of costs and credits, would, unless prices were very high, would see reduced taxes. So that concludes my presentation. I would be happy to answer questions if there are any.
You would have caught me with my mouth full. Anyway, thank you, Roger. Are there any questions for Roger at this time?
Seeing none.
I heard our bells ring. As Robin alluded to a while ago, if there are questions that committee members would like to have answered, that may be sent to run them through my office. That way we can get them formulated. Get them to the department, get the questions answered, and get them back to all committee members so that they're not spending their time answering each of our questions six times. It would be a help to them, plus they probably have had that question, or possibly had that question asked before in previous committees. No other questions. I'd like to thank the department, Dan, Robin, and Roger for being here. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at 2, and we'll continue the presentation by the administration, as well as hear from House Resource Committee Co-Chair Ralph Sanders. So with that, Representative Weirach.
When do you want to start talking amendments?
When you have one to propose. Yeah. Let's start looking at them and seeing how they affect the CS and get the questions out there so we can get back the answers. With that, thank the committee members for being here. Once again, thank the department, and meeting's adjourned.